Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. I normally don't play commentators, what they have to say, because I'd rather talk to people who actually are professional. Either they're in the political realm, they're in the policy realm. But it was very interesting the other night when Fox News commentator Tucker Carlson took an unannounced vacation from his show, and that followed his commentary in which he said that white supremacy, like Russia, was a hoax.
But the whole thing is a lie. If you were to assemble a list, a hierarchy of concerns, of problems this country faces, where would white supremacy be on the list? Right up there with Russia, probably. It's actually not a real problem in America. The combined membership of every white supremacist organization in this country would be able to fit inside a college football stadium? I mean, seriously. This is a country where the average person is getting poorer, where the suicide rate is spiking. White supremacy, that's the problem. This is a hoax. Just like the Russia hoax, it's a conspiracy theory used to divide the country and keep a hold on power. That's exactly what's going on.
That's Fox News host Tucker Carlson. Joining me now is Tom Mochaitis, professor of history at DePaul University, specialist on terrorism, author of a new book, Violent Extremists, Understanding the Domestic and International Terrorist Threat. And Tom, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Good morning.
I had to play that cut thinking of you because, I'm sorry, I thought that was one of the most stupidest things I've ever seen.
Yeah, and, you know, it, not only is it stupid, it's absolutely incorrect. I mean, the research I've done shows that you've got to look more at, than just at the members. And by the way, we don't even have membership roles for most of these organizations, but the estimates run at as high as 22 million people who have at least some sympathy with the white nationalist, which quite honestly is a euphemism for white supremacist ideology.
You noted that following the El Paso shooting, these kind of issues involving the president's rhetoric, and that no one's saying he, you know, pulled the trigger here or anything, let's stop right there. But that when you do have kind of rhetoric like that, it's enabling.
Yeah, there's a term one expert coined called motivational complicity. You have to be aware when you are a leader that what you say has enormous power. And when you speak in such inflammatory terms, you are helping to put a target on the back of members of the minority group who's, you know, who you are talking about. And you can't ignore the fact that in his campaign rallies before the midterm elections a year ago, he was using words like invasion repeatedly, and that's exactly the language that the El Paso shooter used.
And basically, you know, professed to admire the Christchurch, New Zealand shooter.
Yes.
I mean, how much of this is kind of this reciprocal kind of, or I guess for lack of a better term, kind of copycat kind of thing?
Yeah, I refer to it as a nexus of ideology and hate. In other words, what we're seeing is a movement throughout the U.S. and now, sadly, throughout the Western world in which there's a great deal of cross-pollinization influence via social media and the Internet, where one will inspire the other. The Christchurch shooter mentioned Dylann Roof, the young man who killed 9 African-Americans at a church in Charleston. He also mentioned Anders Breivik in Norway. Now you've got the shooter in El Paso who's, in fact, mentioning the Christchurch shooter. And they're all driven by this ideology, which is disseminated largely online.
Is social media an enabler then too?
Yeah, social media. Yeah, I mean it's a tool and it can be used as an enabler. I mean, you know, social media is like the weather in Chicago. You can complain about it all you want. It's not going anywhere. I mean, it can be a powerful force for good. I mean, in the aftermath of Charleston, it was a, you know, a social media campaign that got the governor of South Carolina to take down the Confederate flag from the state capitol. So, you know, there are examples of it being used both ways, but there's no question that it makes radicalization easier because for two reasons. One, it is a self-isolating phenomenon. You disconnect yourself from the real world around you, and your frame of reference becomes these extreme views and these extreme people online. The other is you don't need face-to-face interaction anymore. Timothy McVeigh, the Oklahoma City bomber, I mean, to spread his message, he used to carry copies of the Turner Diaries, which is kind of the was the Bible of the anti-government movement at that time, around in the trunk of his car and sell him at gun shows and wherever he happened to be. Now you can get all the material online, and you have all these blogs, blog sites, websites, many on the dark web, even Facebook pages, where you can they can reinforce each other's hatred.
Well, see, and that's kind of what I was alluding to with social media is that it's easier for these twisted-minded people to associate with others.
Right, exactly right. In fact, there's even been some research to show that there is an uptick. In other words, you can see a change in both the frequency and the nature of their online posts. People have looked at Stormfront, which is the largest white supremacist website. It's actually a blog out there, and you know, people will, before they're violent, I think Breivik was on there, and several others were something like 100 people who were engaged in shootings or some kind of attack were on there. And what would happen is, before the attack, in the weeks or so before, suddenly the increase in the number of posts, and also an increase in the violent language. And so that's an interesting thing in and of itself. They just stopped a potential attack in Las Vegas, and they did it based on what the person was putting online. So maybe we're starting to see some progress in that direction.
But do you think companies like Facebook and Twitter are doing enough?
No. You know, it's interesting to listen to Mark Zuckerberg saying, and I had a very good student of mine write a paper on the challenges of doing it using things like machine learning and
artificial intelligence.
Yeah, I mean, things that are not my area of expertise. But on the other hand, I think they're doing it somewhat the wrong way. They're trying to vacuum up all of this information that's out on all Facebook sites. To me, what you need to do is to target the Facebook pages of the designated hate groups. You know, you got a concentration right there. I mean, why are some of these groups even, why does it even allow them to have Facebook pages? I mean, okay, freedom of expression, but, you know, there are limits on that. And, you know, but if, as long as you start focusing on specific words, you're not going to get anywhere, because what has happened with the white supremacist movement is they've cleaned up the offensive language. They've turned it on its head. You know, it's no longer about hating people of color. It's about celebrating your European heritage. It's about white pride. It's about, you know, not apologizing for being a straight white male and all of these other kinds of things, which makes it sound far more acceptable to people who would not wish to call themselves or be called a racist. So by taking the language out, it not only makes it hard to look for the dangerous posts, it also makes it easier to spread the ideology.
Well, it's always trying to find that euphemism to change things around, and so that you know, I'm a nationalist. I'm, you know, that, well, what does that really mean?
Yeah, they wrap themselves in, that's the other thing, they wrap themselves in the flag, and they even turn it around. Well, if you criticize me, you're a racist against white people. You know, racism is connected to power. I mean,
right.
The power to dominate others. And so, you know, that piece is in there. But, you know, the idea that if you disagree with them, well, that the president does it all the time. Well, the representative in Baltimore is the real racist because he criticizes me. Well, no, it doesn't work that way. He's not using language that targets your, you know, racial, ethnic, religious, or other, you know, identities. He's calling you out on what you're saying. There's a huge difference.
We're speaking to Tom Okatis. He is professor of history at DePaul University and the author of a new book, Violent Extremists, Understanding the Domestic and International Terrorist Threat. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in WGN Skyline Studio. And joining me on the phone is Tom Akitis, professor of history at DePaul University, author of Violent Extremists, Understanding the Domestic and International Terrorist Threat. And Tom, I want to play this cut from the president when he was asked about his divisive rhetoric, including the use of the term invasion to describe illegal immigrants. And reporters basically said that you use the term invasion, that's the same term that was used by the El Paso gunman.
You and the shooter in El Paso use that same language. Do you regret that?
I think that illegal immigration, you're talking about illegal immigration, right? Yes. I think illegal immigration is a terrible thing for this country. I think you have to come in legally. Ideally, you have to come in through merit. We need people coming in because we have many companies coming into our country. They're pouring in. And I think illegal immigration is a very bad thing for our country. I think open borders are a very bad thing for our country. And we're stopping. We're building a wall right now. We won the lawsuit in the Supreme Court 2 weeks ago. The wall is well under construction. It's being built at a rapid pace. We need that. We need strong immigration laws, but we want to allow millions of people to come in because we need them. We have companies coming in from Japan, all over Europe, all over Asia. They're opening up companies here. They need people to work. We have a very low unemployment rate. So I believe we have to have legal immigration, not illegal immigration.
So he never talks about the use of the word invasion.
No, he knows, and this is, well, I mean, to be fair, all politicians do that. He pivots away from the question and gets back to what he wants his message to be. But there's no question that, you know, words have enormous power. I just wrote a small op-ed on and put it up on Medium and Twitter where, you know, there was a mayor of Vienna in 1895 named Karl Liger, and he discovered that anti-Semitism was very effective for motivating, you know, Viennese working class voters and getting him elected. And yet he had close Jewish friends. So someone said to him, well, how do you do this? He goes, oh, I decide who's a Jew. The point being, like Donald Trump, he was an opportunist. He was not ideologically driven. I don't think Donald Trump is an ideologue. I think he saw in this a powerful tool to get himself elected and push his agenda. But the problem is who you motivate. There happened to be a young unemployed artist in Vienna named Adolf Hitler, who was a great admirer of Liger. Now, Liger would have been horrified to see the fruits of the seeds that he had sown, but he was still partly responsible. Donald Trump was not seeking to motivate anybody to shoot anyone. That's not true. But he has to own, and he won't, but he should own some of the responsibility for the language. Remember John McCain when someone said, oh, Barack Obama is not a real American, he wasn't born here, and John McCain said, no, 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 he's a good person I just happen to disagree with. We need that. We need a return of that kind of discourse.
But can we ever get back?
Oh, I'm an always a glass half full sort of person. I think we can. I think the mobilization of, look, here's the other thing for me that what gives me great hope and great optimism is, besides the young people I teach and my grandchildren and the future and so on, is that you could stop immigration right this very minute and not let a single person in, and by this country will still continue to be increasingly diverse. By the middle of the century, there will be no majority population. That is what is frightening people who get around this ideology they call white nationalism, and they say, oh, I can get my country back. Well, what do you mean by back? We've always been diverse, but we're going to truly be a rainbow nation, and they cannot stop that. And I see that as a good thing, but I understand that people can be afraid of it. Even though, ironically, the most staunch adherence to this ideology are people located in areas where they have very little contact with diversity. The man from Dallas drove all the way to El Paso to find people to kill.
Right, right. We've got a call from Ron. Ron, thanks for joining us on the Sunday Spin.
Yes, good morning, Rick, and to your guests. I'm a professor. I'm looking forward to reading your book.
Thank you.
Typically, you see an increase in these attitudes and behavior when the economy is look bad and there's some tension and insecurity relative to the economy. So if we believe that the economy, as the president just mentioned, is good, then maybe you can just talk about what you attribute a lot of this uptick to this attitudes. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for your question. First of all, I think one of the, I think it was Kamala Harris mentioned in the first debate that, the economy's doing okay, measured by low unemployment, but people are working two and three jobs to make ends meet, and, wages have been stagnant for a long time. It's about relative inequality that is driving this. And the other thing is fear is irrational. You know, people cannot, you say, what exactly are you afraid of? What is going to happen? I mean, you have a town somewhere in the rural South passing a law against Sharia without even knowing what it is, as though somebody's actually going to go there and try to impose it. So there's an element of the irrational, but there's also an element of anxiety over rapid change and the perception of losing one's privileged position relative to everybody else.
They just don't want to say that it's a privilege.
Yeah, they don't. And the irony of it is, if they stopped, took a deep breath, look at their own situation, they'd realize they're getting the short end of the stick just as much as the minority groups they're targeting. I mean, some of the staunchest supporters of the president are being hurt by his policies. Look at the farmers in the Midwest, soybeans, pork producers, people shipping these things to China, which are now, they're suffering a minor recession from what's going on, and yet they hang in there because they feel better. Well, Lyndon Johnson, I think, said it. You know, take the poorest white person, tell him he's better than the best off person of color, and he will be your supporter. I mean, it's sad, but it does work.
Well, and that's why I asked about going back to that question about can we ever go back to kind of normalcy is the way that our conversation is today and the way social media is today and the fact that, sure, as you just mentioned, though some of the president's staunchest supporters are people who are hurt by his, trade war policies, but they like the idea that, he's not conventional.
Take real leadership, and I'm troubled to some degree to be fair and balanced about the way in which some people in the Democratic Party are staking up a take no prisoners, them and us kind of mentality. I don't think that's healthy either. I mean, there is certainly a problem of leadership here, but ideally the thing is your political opponents are not your enemies. I mean, I remember a day, when I could vote for somebody like John Porter, who was in a party that I normally don't, he's a Republican, I normally didn't vote for him, but he was a man of high integrity, very principled, willing to listen, willing to compromise, and having the best interests of the country at stake. I hope we can get away from the extreme ideologically driven positions back to that more respectful thing. It's going to be hard, but as I said, I'm optimistic that if we work at it, we can.
Well, as we've seen, when what we talk about compromise, that's viewed as others as political weakness and lack of political purity.
Again, I'm hearing it in some of the debate, too, that there is an element of pragmatism. They're saying about politics, it's the art of the possible. It's what you can actually get done. And, I think to a certain degree, during the 2016 election, some of the postmortem of that was, the failure of the Clinton campaign to go down into, Bill Clinton was saying that, actually, to them, we need to get to small-town America. They may not support us, but they need to believe they're heard. I think that's a large part of it, whoever gets in should not gloat about their victory. They really should try to heal the country and move forward.
That's Professor Tom Mikaitis from DePaul University, professor of history, specialist on terrorism, insurgency, and counterinsurgency. Violent Extremists is his book, Understanding the Domestic and International Terrorist Threat. Professor, we're going to post a link to that on our Facebook page as well. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Well, thank you for having me, and have a nice day.